this whole movement of the US wanting cheap stuff has made China into a superpower.
China is a manufacturing beast, the likes of which makes Japan and Korea before it look like pipsqueaks.
We're getting a short-term sugar high on cheap prices on products so that we can be fattened up for slaughter.
Every single one of them would love to crack the US market, get access here, because there's the promise of growth and profitability.
You're trying to create the incentive for the right result to happen. What's the incentive?
Yes.
I want manufacturing in the United States. How do you make manufacturing happen in the United States? You make the stuff coming in way more expensive so that people have an incentive to build here, and you give them some carrots to build here.
China's the only country I know of that actually calls itself the center of the world. Zhongguo is the Chinese name. It means middle kingdom or the center kingdom. The party is like God. It's everywhere, but you can't see it.
Last time we had you on, okay, we left, we started a conversation and kind of left the conversation with, man, talking about the automotive industry, talking about broader industry, manufacturing, supply chain. The conversation was, boy, China looks like they are sort of a freight train towards domination. And the United States is completely and utterly, I'm going to try to be nice.
Unprepared.
Yes. Just perhaps a little behind and trying their best, right? And this was pre-election. And now post-election with a brand new administration that, and this is where I love to get your take, it seems like it's been flipped 180, that the there's been a refocus, a reshift, a fundamentally different approach to how to operate the country, how to position itself, how to embrace domestic businesses, how to position itself internationally. And I'm really curious to get your high level take, and I'm sure we'll dig in as much as we need to. What is your sense post election now? So like if we're going to talk about, let's rehash the conversation, right? What's different now? How do you feel now post election?
Tariffs are front and center. So this started with the first Trump administration. He was the one to recognize and initially put tariffs on Chinese car imports, even though we didn't have any Chinese cars on the road here. That happened way back in 2016. And at the time, no one really took notice. Since then, the Biden administration has doubled down on that, raising tariffs on Chinese cars to 100%, also putting in some blockers. If the cars feature Chinese software or hardware, the message is we don't want the Chinese to have access to our market, certainly not exporting from China. So, and that's been effective. That's been effective up until now. With the new administration, where to from here? How do you engage with a China that is bigger, faster, lower cost, higher quality than what we have here in the United States? One possibility is that President Trump wakes up one day and says, hey, you know what? China plays a more advanced game when it comes to electrics. We probably need some electrics and batteries here in our own country. We'll invite them in. BYD's agreed to invest $10 billion and hire 20,000 workers and put plants and supply chains into the heart of America. We're going to do a great deal. It'll be a joint venture. We'll find an American partner and so on. But I think the major takeaway is the United States is aware that China is a manufacturing beast, the likes of which makes Japan and Korea before it look like pipsqueaks. They're so big and ferocious. They're going into markets worldwide. And our first take is time out, tariffs, don't let them in. Second take is how do we compete with this new giant kid on the block?
What have you heard sort of inside China? Some of, you know, I'm assuming you still have, I mean, last time we discussed, you have a lot of discussions with the Chinese and companies out there. And just for those that are not aware, we brought back Michael. Listen to the first podcast. Michael is extremely well-versed in the manufacturer supply chain industries in China as they relate to the United States, sort of how those two things come together internationally, so on and so forth. It's just a phenomenal resource. What are the conversations like now inside of China post-Trump?
Here's where they're coming from. They sort of have a mentality, it's export or die. China has way too much capacity at home, price wars. No one outside of BYD is making profits at home. So the mantra is get out, export or invest overseas. If we stay at home, we'll drown in our own overcapacity. And Chinese automakers, every single one of them, would love to crack the U.S. market, get access here, because there's the promise of growth and profitability. And at the same time, I was just talking to some Chinese automakers last week, and they said, we understand the current environment. We're not really welcome. So we're waiting for things to settle down, and maybe there will be an opening. They're talking about in 2026 for an entry. But there's no doubt about it. They would love, they'd kill to have access to the U.S. market.
I wonder, what do you think the discussions are? So let's role play, right? Let's say they are able to crack that nut with the Trump administration. Trump says, okay, let's make a great deal. Bilateral, we get perks in China. Maybe we're able to do more of the Tesla model where we're 100%, we have 100%, owned American companies in China. Elon and Trump are very, they're his second buddy or whatever they call him, the first buddy. They have a very close relationship. Elon mm-hmm. has phenomenal ties with the Chinese government. He has a wholly owned business out there. Maybe it's like, okay, let us adopt a Tesla model in China, and then we'll let you come here. You know, like you said, BYD, commit to build out $10, $20 billion worth of manufacturing capacity, whatever. Li Auto, Xpeng, whatever, all those other companies. What does legacy auto fit into that equation, right? Because I'm thinking about the existing capacity for Ford, existing capacity for GM, Stellantis, so on and so forth. It feels like they would be gigantic losers from this dynamic. You know, the UAW used to be super close with the Biden administration, kind of up in the air what kind of relationship they have with the Trump and his administration. Isn't that inherently terrible for the existing capacity for legacy auto in the United States?
Absolutely. They would find themselves extremely vulnerable. Jim Farley said as much, it's existential threat, the Chinese. So there's two on paper that looks almost ideal in terms of opening things up. We'll let them in here and they let us flourish in China. The trouble is, in my experience, my many years on the ground in China, when you talk about doing business or engaging with the Chinese, bottom line, it's all about leverage. And the Chinese feel as though they have the upper hand now, and they're going to be tougher and tougher on foreign companies operating in China. We've already seen it. GM sales are down by more than 50% from their peak. Ford's down 70%. Jeep's joint venture already went bankrupt. It's like the beginning of the end for foreign companies in China. Farzad, I think you're a big football fan. Penn State, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so what is it like to compete in China as a foreign automaker? Imagine it's November and you're going to Columbus playing the away game. No, you don't want to, right?
We've lost eight straight against those suckers. I hate that. You just give me anxiety.
Now, the anxiety of going into the horseshoe and playing Ohio State away in deep in winter.
Forget it.
Now, on top of that, it's a forever away game. That's the way I think of it, having lived there. And what do I mean by that? Imagine there's a controversial call, Penn State interference is called at Penn State. There's a review. Officials go to the sideline to review it. Look in the cameras. Who do they consult with? They don't consult with an independent body. They consult with the president of Ohio State University. Well, how did you see the call, Mr. President of Ohio State University? That's the party in China.
That already happens, Michael. That already happens with the Buckeyes.
Oh, my goodness. It's already happening here. You get my point. In China, there's always you'd like to believe that it's open and independent and a market-based economy. It's not. The party has the final say. The expression on the ground in China is the party is like God. It's everywhere, but you can't see it. So when you go to China, you'll see the skyscrapers and beautiful luxury hotels and the great modern cars. And you think this is capitalism on steroids. But behind the scenes, invisible to us, is this, master maker called the party that directs and shapes outcomes. So what is that? Why do I share that background? Because when we begin to think about some kind of relationship between the United States and China, ideally, both sides would open up. But I don't think we can bank on China opening up from here.
How do you see that playing out if we were to do a deal with them where they could come to the United States market, if they brought supply chains here, if they brought manufacturing capacity here. How does that change the game on the field as far as leverage? I love the conversation that you had recently on your podcast, which is Driving with Dunn with Ken Wilcox. And, you know, one of the things that you talked about was that it's always about leverage, always about leverage, always about leverage. And there is no such thing as win-win when you are working with a Chinese partner. And so I want to disabuse viewers that there is a necessarily win-win solution that is available by bringing Chinese competitors here into the United States. Yeah, I'd just love to hear you riff on that. And what are your thoughts?
Right. In the Chinese vernacular, win-win, they call it shuang ying. Win-win means China wins twice.
That's good.
And they're very clever. When you negotiate with them, you're sitting across a table and I guarantee they'll say, open up by saying, two great companies, you guys and us, win-win. Let's craft a win-win. What they're really thinking, though, in Chinese is, ni si wo huo, as you die, I live, in Chinese. So, tough. They're tough negotiators, and we should not be naive. They look at Americans, and they typically take us as pretty naive. And so, if they were to come here, I'd recommend to the administration to do the same thing that China did when foreign automakers went there, except for Tesla, and that is insist on the home team, American companies, having 51% or more of the joint venture, and insist on vigilant tracking of their activities here in the United States. It may sound paranoid. I hope it doesn't. It's just being realistic. They are hard-nosed competitors. They're ambitious as hell, and they know no limits. So if we invite the tiger into the United States, we need to make sure we have proper safety protocol in place to make sure they don't eat us up. Yeah. That's the reality.
I think here's like where I'm sort of, it's just a very curious observation. Like even in a scenario where the Trump administration, let's just assume it's a better administration to have in relation to China versus say previous administrations, because of their ability to harness, these relationships with, say, not just Chinese, but with other companies, and with the goal of like everybody winning, right? Like everybody wins, you know, we win, you win, so on and so forth. And the Chinese will say, well, we win twice, whatever. Like trying to at least make a deal that works instead of just being run over by China. It still feels like even under that scenario, the work they've put in for the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years to build up a supply chain, to build them in a manufacturing base will still bear fruit. Because they're going to be able to come to the United States or wherever else. They're still already selling in parts in Europe. They're already selling in South America. They're already selling in parts in Africa and broader Asia, right? The United States is the last bit that they haven't gotten into yet.
We're on an island, Farzad. We're on an island here. Yes.
Yeah. So regardless, they win anyway because the United States has been so far behind in capacity building, right? So is there any world... Like what I'm trying to go through is like, is there any world where the United States does have a closed door policy with China that says we're going to make tariffs so prohibitive that's going to be impossible for you to get in, and we're going to do everything possible to build up our manufacturing process so that we become the dominant power when it comes to manufacturing and supply chain and so on and so forth. Even under a Trump administration, even if Elon sort of was able to clone his brain and give it to every auto CEO in the country, it still feels like that wouldn't be enough, at least in the next 10, 20 years, to catch up to the momentum that China has built, right? So it's like it's almost like you either let them in or you get run over anyway. That's what it feels like to me. I don't want to be pessimistic, but this is kind of where I am at. How do you read that?
Yeah, it's you're absolutely 100% correct. That's the reality that we face today. If you look up and down the line, China produces three times as many cars as the United States. It produces more electric vehicles than the whole rest of the world combined. It has absolute control over battery supply chains and processing. It owns it. It owns the show. So you look around, you go, my goodness, what are our options? We're not in charge. They are. We're the underdogs. Now, having said all that, I do remember when I first went to China back in the late 1980s, China had absolutely nothing, zero capability to manufacture its own cars, capital, know-how, management expertise, technology, zero. What did they do? They threw up 100% tariffs and said, everyone who wants access to this market must invest here and form joint ventures here. And that's done very well for China. So in a way, as an American, I'd say, let's try to buy time, keep those tariff walls up. If anybody wants access to the market here, you have to bring a lot of money and partner. And in the meantime, we really need at home to accelerate our efforts to do R&D and innovation and duplicate what Tesla. Thank goodness we have Tesla on our side. Without that, things are looking like it's curtains. So I do believe the Chinese did a long game. Americans are impatient. But in this instance, to fight the fight, we need to buy some time and really have a renaissance in our own industry here inside the United States.
Let me ask a sort of follow-up here. How do you think I think that the coverage of the demographics in China are very well covered, you know, ever since they stopped, you know, they instituted that, what was it, one-child policy or two-child policy? I forget what it was, but they put an arbitrary policy to sort of curtail births because they couldn't keep up with the population growth. So you have that, and now you have this sort of demographic collapse, and if you just push that out 20, 30, 40 years down the road, China is not going to be in a great position from that perspective. And then since COVID, it seems like there's been a flight away from China for manufacturing and supply chain and a diversification in places like India and places like, Indonesia and stuff, like around the Asia Pacific. So how much of that do you think is hurting China's ability to have as much leverage as they did, let's say, 3-4 years ago, especially now with the Trump administration that's come in, that theoretically should supercharge domestic manufacturing? Do you think that's playing into this at all?
We're right in that sweet spot. We're at a critical, pivotal moment where if we can hold our ground a little bit, give ourselves a little bit of time to allow manufacturing to rise here at home, we are seeing backlash in several countries around the world now. Europe began last year putting tariffs on Chinese imports. Brazil, Mexico, having change of heart. Oh my goodness, these Chinese products are overwhelming our domestic industries. So there is a little bit of backlash, a little bit of pushback, and it's political, it's geopolitics, and China's aware of this. So you mentioned the demographic. If we wait them out, their demographics 5-10 years from now don't look as good as they do right now. They're peaking. So in a way, we have to fight our, like, Americans are typically so impatient. We want to just get things on. Let's be patient, slow it down. Time is really on our side if we can hold the line, hold the ground.
And the other thing that comes to mind too is, like, I have this sort of optimist sort of shirt, like the Tesla robot. But I do think in the next 3 to 5 years, we are going to see a revolution in artificial intelligence, humanoid robots, automated labor. That, you know, and I know China's working on this too, right? It's not like just the United States is going to win here, but it does seem like the United States is ahead in AI capability. Grok 3 just came out a couple of days ago, and it looks like it's just as good, if not better, than the leading models in the world. And it costs, I don't know, what is it, 80%, 70% less than OpenAI's best model. Not as free as DeepSeek R1's open source model, but at least the United States has some. It does seem like they have a path to almost manufactured labor capacity by creating human or robots and so on and so forth. How much of that variable is part of the China strategy moving forward? Have you heard about them trying to move fast into automated labor, human or robots? Because I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, it does seem like the Chinese manufacturing capacity and the supply chain capacity is brute force. You're just throwing as many humans as you can at the problem, right? And that's how you're winning. You're just throwing gobs of cheap labor because you have it at the problem, and that's why you're ahead. Can you walk me through that and what you're hearing?
Let's look at BYD, for example. It's astonishing to me. They now have 1 million employees at that automaker, including more than 100,000 engineers doing R&D, and just some outrageous number of patents that they're filing. So they do continue to have a decisive advantage when it comes to labor costs. It's just a reality. Now, having said that, China's sort of both and right now. They're the single largest installer of robotics into their factories of any country in the world by a far margin. So if you go to the newest car companies like a Xiaomi or others, you're going to be astonished to see, wow, they have robotics. They're advanced manufacturing. They're right there with us. So we cannot underestimate their capabilities or their drive. They have both the lower labor costs and they're pushing really hard on robots in their factories. I think one decisive advantage that we have here in the West, in the United States, is something that Elon talks about a lot, and that is freedom of speech. And it's hard to measure, but it's real. You know, I started my first company in China way back in the 1990s. And I remember my first hire told me this wisdom, the deep wisdom. She said, you have in China two markets you have to take care of. You as an American understand one market's the consumer. The other market is the government. You have to take care of the people in the government so that those regulators are on your side when it's crunch time. And what did I do as an American at the time? I told her, well, that's the most idiotic thing I've ever heard in my life. We don't mess with government. We leave government alone. We're just here to serve the customer. And she smiled and nodded and said, well, okay, this American's going to have to learn his own way. So the point is that, you know, you hear about Tesla in China, you always hear two names, Grace Tao and Tom Zhu. Grace Tao is there to take care of the government market side, and Tom Zhu's there to run the business. So all that exhaustive work required to operate in China tells me that in an environment of free speech, what we enjoy here in the United States, we're going to be able to stay steps ahead, especially when we have Elon and Jensen Huang and others on our side. That's really a phenomenal advantage, not to be can't overstate just how important that is. Having lived in this pressure cooker called China, where you always have one eye on the customer and the other eye on the regulator.
So in thinking about how Elon has navigated all of this up to this point, between Tesla, but even, I mean, he also has a lot more leverage to bring to the situation because of not only SpaceX, but like Farzad said, his involvement now as a member of Doge and his proximity to the president. How would you grade Elon's acuity in his dealings with China and his ability to achieve an actual win for America in the long term against China?
Second to none. Exceptional. He's done exceptionally well. He's gone further, faster than any other auto company and arguably any other American company in China. That they built the plant in record time. He negotiated 100% ownership, which was unprecedented. No one got that access. The first year, they blew through even the most optimistic estimates. I was just looking at notes. I'm writing a book about this. They were hoping that, you know, people were saying if they can sell 50,000 units in the first year in China, that'll be a miracle. They sold 135,000. They really set the pace. Chinese automakers, customers, government officials all are in awe and have deep respect and abiding respect for Elon and for Tesla. So all those are two thumbs up for what Elon's done so far in China. Now, having said that, he's surrounded by, you know, this gaggle of Chinese car makers. There's a lot of them, and they have resources, and they're at home. So he's got to do everything in his power to fend them off, and that the best way to do that is innovation. So that's what he's done up until now in China. He has to keep innovating in order to stay relevant and competitive there. That's just a reality. And then here at home, my dream is that he spawns other Teslas, you know, with the same kind of mindset. We need more Teslas in America. We can't just always rely on Elon and Tesla alone to carry the bags for us. Yeah.
And in thinking about that leverage back and forth, how do you see that playing out with FSD in China and cyber cabs? Because this seems like, you know, FSD is applied real world artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is a hot and heavy battleground between the United States and China in this friendly co-opetition slash not so friendly Cold War 2.0 environment of two great powers. And, you know, Elon's kind of caught in the middle of all that. And FSD is a critical piece on the chessboard. So it seems like there are forces at play in Tesla's ability to roll out something like FSD in China that are much, much deeper than in any other market in the rest of the world.
Absolutely. It's he himself just weeks ago said we're in a little bit of a bind. We cannot bring the China stuff back to the US for training, and we can't train inside China. So he's in a pickle, and he's forthright about it. And then on top of that, he doesn't have the almighty license to proceed yet with FSD nationally inside China. So they've given it to him to operate in the greater Shanghai area. But for this to be a real go, he needs a license for national rollout. And that's what's sort of hanging there, suspended. We still don't know if and when that will come. China's using its leverage, saying, how much do we need Tesla to learn from anymore? Can our own guys do it? That's their measure. It's nothing personal. It's just how the Chinese do business. Like, how relevant are you to us? 20 years ago, GM got the red carpet, was like a god in China because it had advanced manufacturing and great products at the time for China. Today, GM's more or less on its way out. It's no longer useful. So FSD is massively important to Tesla globally. If it can crack China, huge upside. I just want to be realistic about how the Chinese are coming at this and how they'll deploy their own automakers to sort of be a substitute to Tesla as soon as they can.
I do wonder if, like, sort of just went through my head, is like, we know that self-driving technology is going to get commoditized at some point. It's too valuable. It's too important. It saves too many lives. It increases the utility of a vehicle by 5-10x. It's a no-brainer technology that everyone's going to race to adopt. But with it come some pretty severe privacy concerns, especially like do you really, like, let's say in a world where we have reciprocal trade and we kind of open doors up and BYD can come in and they have their own version of FSD 5-10 years down the road, are we really sure we want Chinese cameras everywhere? I don't know. That doesn't seem like a good idea, right? That seems like you've just, everybody's just spying on each other 24/7. So I do wonder if, like, FSD like technology becomes lockdown per region, where maybe Tesla can sell a Tesla car in China, or GM can, maybe that part of the deal is like, yo, we'll JV and the joint venture in the US with you, BYD, but Ford has to take a stake, or GM has to take a stake, whatever. Like, figure out a way so that legacy automakers don't just die and the entire industry collapses, right? But when that when we're ready to put FSD on the BYD, we're going to put the Tesla's FSD, we're not going to put China's FSD. And likewise, in China, we'll sell you the Tesla car, but you put on the BYD FSD, not the Tesla FSD. I wonder, like, do you think that I'm curious to get y'all's take on that. Like, is that even a thing that could be one of the ways to open up the doors and be like, okay, the technology is going to go forward, everyone wins, and we still keep the privacy concerns sort of at bay because the technology we're using for driving the vehicle is localized. It's not, you know, back in the headquarters of the other place, like TikTok, right? There's a reason why there's a ban on TikTok, is because they're probably doing some shady shit, right? So,
Did you see how President Trump summarized that the other day? He said, okay, let's just go right to the heart of matter. TikTok's either a $1 trillion company or it's worth zero. So, if it's 100% owned by the Chinese, it'll be worth zero. If you have an American partner, it could be worth $1 trillion. So, I love your solution. Let's not fight it. Let's recognize that each country does not trust the other very much. So if you want to bring your products here, you use our national FSD systems and vice versa. I love that solution. Rather than fighting it and insisting, and as you said, those FSD systems can vacuum up so much data It's unbelievable. And in China today, they already have 400 million cameras around the country. You can't go many city blocks walking without seeing, oh, hello, I'm on another camera. They have it down to a science. So we wouldn't want those that type of information being collected on our roads and then going back to China. And nor would they. Yeah.
Yeah. Anzo, want to jump in?
I was just thinking about the principle of reciprocity and how important that is going to be in this whole negotiation back and forth with China, you know, for the next several decades. That, and it's one of the things that that Trump recognized early on, is that, hey, you know, free trade is great if people are engaging in free trade with high levels of integrity, but when people are cynically using free trade in order to gain leverage on you and then exploit you and then destroy you over time, then it's not free trade anymore. And we have got to recognize the field as it lies and own up to the fact that the world is not all on board with free trade, and we can't pretend that it is, that is naive. And so I really like the idea of the reciprocity, you know, both with, whether it's with TikTok, whether it's with FSD, whether it's with Huawei, like, you know, China's not letting FSD in their or letting Tesla in with FSD into China. Why should we let Huawei and these other companies bring their technology here to the United States if it's a security threat for them, for us to have our technology there? Well, then we had better assume that it would be the same in reverse.
Yeah, up until very recently, there's just been this incredible dichotomy. Like, the United States, wide open. My Chinese friends who set up businesses here, they're like, I can't believe it. You just walk in and set up and you're going? This is like a miracle. And then you go to China and there's layer after layer after layer of bureaucracy and licenses and permissions that you never get there. So one of the things people, I feel like, don't talk about enough, China is the largest car market in the world by far. Sold 25 million cars last year. 97% of those cars were manufactured inside China. 97. That means imports 3%. Come back to America. Last year, 47% of the cars we bought here in America were imported. Now, many of those came from Mexico and Canada, but millions also came from Europe, Japan, and Korea. So we're still wide open. And yet people are thinking, oh my goodness, President Trump put in place these tariffs on cars. Well, just look at China or Japan or Korea. They have single digit imports. And it's just been like that for so long that people take for granted, oh, let's not bother with China too much. They seem friendly enough. Well, hang on. Their door is shut. Our door is wide open. Let's have this reciprocity, Hans, that you're talking about. And let's really make it have teeth this time.
Yeah, I think the tariff discussion, when I'm trying to listen to it from some of the punditry class, I guess, and this is my mistake, is I'm listening to the wrong sources. It's very shallow and sort of misses the entire point, right? It's like, oh well, everyone's prices are going to go up. It's like, okay, do you understand that the United States has no manufacturing capacity? Like, do you, like, there's an end result here. You're trying to create the incentive for the right result to happen. What's the incentive?
Yes.
I want manufacturing in the United States. How do you make manufacturing happen in the United States? You make the stuff coming in way more expensive so that people have an incentive to build here, and you give them some carrots to build here. And then everybody wins. You get more people working here and it's local. You get a local supply chain. You get local transportation, local logistics. The entire thing works to your advantage. And almost every other major power is doing it. Right. It's just like
every other major power is doing it. You're absolutely right. And we're the odd one out. And so I agree with you when you hear people, I say tariffs, not a bad idea in the current climate. What? That means our prices go up. Hold on. What's the purpose of those tariffs? Drive manufacturing inside the United States. And China does it. Korea does it. Japan does it. Germany does it. So it's time for the U.S. to do it too. Short term, I think the prices will go up. That's inevitable. We have a trend. We can't just snap our fingers, but That's the big idea behind the tariffs. It's not just simply, oh, because we felt like it, let's just put tariffs on everybody.
Yeah, I think that's one of the characteristics of actual good leadership is that you have a goal in mind that is long-term, that provides a lot of benefits, mm-hmm. and you are willing to absorb the short-term pain that's required, the short-term discipline, the short-term discomfort, and you lay out a vision and say, this is why we're, you know, this is going to hurt for a while, but mm-hmm. we're doing it for a reason and it's worth it. Let's go get whatever the prize is. And mm-hmm. I think that that is something that in this instance, free trade is something that is the opposite of that, that we're mm-hmm. getting a short-term sugar high on cheap prices on products so that we can be fattened up for slaughter.
That's the reality.
Yeah. It's like it should be renamed to take advantage of the U.S. tariff or whatever. It makes no
take advantage of the U.S. trade. Everybody happy?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Wait a second. We don't have any manufacturing. Or, of course, we do still have manufacturing, but not nearly enough.
It is a curious discussion, too. It's I feel like it's a cultural thing that has happened with the United States. You know, my parents immigrated here in 99. I'm 38. I haven't been around long enough to say this with complete confidence, but it does feel like the United States has been so used to just the lowest cost possible for things and not really worried about what does that mean to our labor force. They're just like, oh, it's cheaper. Okay. Oh, it's like you said, that short term, but that feels cultural to me. So it's like, how do you put that on its head? How do you fix that so that it goes the other way? It's like, yo, look, what we really should be worried about is how can we have incredibly high quality jobs that we can be proud of that we know is going to be great for us in the long term. And it's also going to come with lower prices eventually. And it's going to come with everybody getting a very good job and everything's here, built here with pride, super high quality. There's no national security concerns. We're not letting China just get incredibly strong. Right? This whole movement of the U.S. wanting cheap stuff has made China into a superpower.
100% agree. 100%. And it's almost like our gospel is, well, if we can get it cheaper from overseas, how can our government deprive us of that right? That's our God-given right as an American citizen. We should have the cheapest product. Hang on, there's a trade-off going on here. China's accumulating more and more manufacturing strength. One third of all manufacturing products last year were made in China. They had $1 trillion trade surplus. One third. By 2035, that could go to half of all manufactured goods if the current trajectory holds. So there's no doubt in my mind, having lived overseas and come back, I sense that cultural thing where we've lost our imagination or we have no memory of the world before getting cheap products was our go-to. And we need to go back to that and reestablish a foundation here. Totally agree. It is cultural.
How much of it is, the cultural deficiency on our part just to want those short-term benefits. But on the flip side, what about the deeper layer? How much of this is a calculated attempt to hoover up all of that manufacturing capacity and to pay the short-term costs of subsidizing those industries and employing legitimately anti-competitive tactics on the global industrial scale, that it's hard, even for people who do want to make products and are willing to pay higher prices and they want to manufacture at home, but they're competing against subsidized competitors that they, the ones with the correct cultural values still die off because they cannot compete against, these subsidized state capitalists.
I'm glad you mentioned that because when people ask me about, China has subsidies and we have subsidies, so they kind of cancel each other out. No. China has a system they call state capitalism that throws everything, they have a target. We are going to own this industry, solar panels, whatever it takes. You want free land, you want low-cost loans, you want zero-interest loans, you want training for your employees, it's free. You want money back when you export. Whatever it takes, we are going to conquer that industry. They've done it in solar panels, in shipbuilding, in steel, you name it. And now their target's firmly on automotive. What do those things look like? There's no end to, it's not like, oh, let's subsidize with 10% rebate. No, it's whatever it takes to win, we're going to do that as a nation. Loans are the biggest one. You know, I went to so many Chinese factories where you go, where do you get all that great new KUKA robotics? Well, we got a loan from the city. How much? $500 million. Oh, okay. Jeez. Okay. Fantastic. And there's no end to those loans. And they're all purposeful. So how do we compete with that? Short term, we have to throw up the tariffs and figure out, hey, if we have, we've got something we've never seen before. And how do we compete with that? We have to buy some time to figure it out.
So where my head goes to on this is, this is another convergence of like, there's so many things happening all at once in the last 12 months and into the next 4 years that it all seems like a simulation, right? So what is that? That it's somehow a combination of an administration that's going to superpower innovation, that is going to lower regulation, and it coincides with the advent of artificial intelligence and robotics. And the reason why I view that as like the thing that could actually get us out of this mess is that the fundamental thing that's allowing China to have the leadership it has, it all goes back to a lot of cheap labor, a lot of very affordable labor that can throw at
and
manufacturing
energy.
Processes and energy. Okay. Yeah.
And money and cheap financing. Yep.
And cheap financing. They just have a massive flywheel to activate labor to make things. Right. And so what's the thing that could realistically beat that in the world that we live in today is manufacturing labor that is cheaper per hour, more affordable per hour than that. And that's where my head goes to. Okay, so human or robots, automated robots, AI powered robots, to me feels like the only way to get out of this, because the United States simply doesn't have, the entirety of North America doesn't have nearly enough people to compete with China. China has 1.4 billion.
No.
Right? This is a numbers game. You know?
It is a numbers game. There's like four Americas in China.
Yeah.
Five. Yeah.
It's crazy, right? So there's four or five Americas in China. So it's like it's going to be, so short of innovating on the per unit of labor, we're going to be left behind, because China's just going to keep accelerating unless we fully, and this is where I get super scared, unless we fully embrace the advent of AI-powered robots, because those are going to be the ones that are going to enable us to leapfrog them in manufacturing capacity. But that opens a completely different can of worms, because now you've created a forcing function to make the price of the labor per hour to be sub $3 per hour or less, which destroys destroys the labor market in a sense. It beats China. It beats China, right? But it also beats everybody.
It's like mutually assured destruction.
Exactly.
Part two. I never thought of that. Yeah, that's kind of scary too. It's almost like, can we just slow time that farther? Do you have a machine at your place where we can slow the time down, the pace?
I don't think that's going to happen. That's the thing. I think that's one of the double-edged swords of this
administration. I think it's going to speed up.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to slow down.
Well, they talk about China's speed, and part of that China's speed, again, comes back to labor. I was talking to some people who looked at BYD and said, how can BYD come with such 25% lower manufacturing costs? What's going on there? So one of the things they do is they'll have multiple teams working on the same motor for one of their vehicles. And those teams are reporting to one boss, and each giving their inputs. Now, we can't think in the, you know, here in the United States, we can't, multiple teams on one item, and then they take the best from each team. They don't have the teams talk to each other. They can just throw so many more human minds at a problem than we are able to do. So it's genuinely like, people ask me, well, you know, we handled the Japanese and the Koreans when they came in and eventually built transplants and everyone more or less got along and happily ever after. This China is a a beast of a manufacturing machine. That
they want to win, right? They want to win.
They want to win. Take all. And not apologize about it. No, they're out to overwhelm markets. And, you know, if you look at their exports last year, number one exporter in the world, number one exporter to Mexico. Almost one third of new cars sold last year in Mexico came from China. Brazil, Australia, UK, they're just all over the place right now.
Can you talk about so I know you briefly touched on this on the previous podcast, but if just for the audience to get a refresher on this, you know, when I say, you know, when I say China wants to win and you say they want to win everything, want to take all, that's very cultural, right? Like China wants the world to be made in the vision of China. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this is some great historical, you know, context. China, many people may not be familiar, but China, we all like, wherever we live, if we live in France or we live in Thailand, or we like to think we're the center of the world, right? You know, the maps are all. China's the only country I know of that actually calls itself the center of the world. Zhongguo is the Chinese name. It means middle kingdom or the center kingdom, the one that's at the middle, at the center. And all other countries in the Chinese mindset are outside of the middle kingdom or Waiguo. And by definition, not quite at the same level as China. That's historically for thousands of years, that's a Chinese mindset. 1800s, British warships show up, opium wars happen, and the Chinese referred to it as the next 150 years of humiliation. One after another, the Westerners, the Americans, the Germans, the French, the British, then the Japanese invaded, humiliation after humiliation. And now China is saying, it's our turn to take center stage. Xi Jinping himself, in speeches, says it's China's turn to return to center stage and be the superpower in the world. U.S. is not going to be in charge in the future from the Chinese perspective. That's serious stuff. And it goes back deep in history. There's a chip on their shoulder. They'd like to have, you call it revenge. They'd like to make up for what they feel is humiliation at the hands of most of the rest of the world for so long. That hasn't been resolved yet. And so when they go to compete, they go to compete as a nation and as companies, and they're hell-bent on winning wherever they go. I say that, guys, without, I'm not here to scare.
It's factual. It's the truth.
It's factual. It's real. I lived it. When I was early days, my first company in China, one day, my director there, very highly educated kid from Beijing University, which is the Harvard of China, I said, what do you think of, you know, GM and Ford and Toyota's coming in and forming these joint ventures inside China to sell their cars? He said, it's okay until we kick your asses out.
Okay. That's literally what happened.
Wow. Wow. Okay. He was clear. He trusted me to say what he was really feeling. And so here we are. More or less, foreign automakers are getting shown the door in China, and the Chinese are expanding very rapidly globally. So if I'm Chinese, I'm feeling, it's our turn. It's our turn to run the show.
Yeah. To me, it sounds like, and again, this is like, I love how our conversations, like the last one and this one, always seem to end, like it's ending on an existential tone, which tells me like we figured out how to sort of distill down the thoughts of what's going on into something that's like maybe like at the fundamental core of what's going on. My interpretation of this conversation so far, given that China has a tremendous advantage in manufacturing, a tremendous advantage in access to cheap labor, supply chain, they have they're building military like psychos, right? I heard a thing where every ship that they've built is a military capable ship that's going to be able to carry payload to countries, right? Every ship is made with that in mind, because probably they want to take Taiwan soon, right? That's one of the things they're trying to do. So it's like, okay, so this is,
you know, what they make no secret, Xi Jinping, it's not a question of if but when China, right? Taiwan comes back to the motherland. That's every day
on a mission. They're on a mission. They know what they want, and they're working towards it. And so to me, it's like the United States has a very simple question to answer. In the next 20 years, do you want to let China take over, like not say like quote unquote take over, but do you just want to say, okay, you are in charge of making everything for us, which by default gives you absolute power truly over what we can and can't do over time? Or do we beat you by embracing artificial intelligence and human or robots so that we can undercut your labor
and freedom of speech
and freedom of speech? Yep. Exactly. And this is how we beat you, right? We beat you by creating 10x the labor force through manufacturing AI power robots, which will open its own insane Pandora's box of, okay, what do we do now? Because, you know, the robots and the AI is doing everything, and it's going to fundamentally disrupt manufacturing and supply chain. But at least we control that capacity, and we don't allow a foreign power to dictate what we should do, right? That's what it seems like to me. It's one or the other. Which one do we want to do?
It's, and standing still is not going to
work.
Not going to work. So let's venture forth into that great unknown and embrace it, because the alternative is just to, you know, hunker down, batten down the hatches, and hope that the guy at the gates goes away. That's not going to happen. They're going to find a way to eventually get into our market. So let's think about innovations is going to continue to be our secret superpower. And that's the one thing the Chinese still acknowledge, that most innovation is coming out of the West and the United States in particular. They're getting much more innovative than they were before, but that's our edge. So let's lean into that one.
And what's crazy is that innovation, the only reason why we're better at innovation is because of freedom of speech. Because we don't have to worry about, oh my God, what if I explore the wrong idea or the wrong thing? Or that is like the fuel to the fire that is innovation. It's freedom of speech.
And the absence of those layers of bureaucracy that you mentioned as well, Michael.
Yes. Yes. Did you guys happen to see there's people fooling around with DeepSeek and asking, like, okay, what's one thing that Xi Jinping's done wrong? And it's like, no. Next question.
And then on the flip side, there's a company called Perplexity that they did post-training on the open source version of R1, and they released it, I think just yesterday. It's called the R1776 model, and they were able to completely undo all of that censorship. And so now there's a free in America version of DeepSeek R1 that has been released, which is pretty
interesting. I love that. Just a reminder for people, you guys know this already, but you go to China, you want to open up your Google or Gmail or YouTube or Twitter or X or Facebook or Instagram. None of those are available.
The WeChat, right?
Sorry, WeChat. You have all, you can use any app you want as long as it's WeChat.
Just like the Ford Model T, you can have it any color as long as it's black.
So we really have two systems of organizing our societies in the world, you know, and maybe we're looking at a world in which there's a communist system or whatever you want to call China's system, state capitalism, and then you have market capitalism. It seems to be a trending that direction.
Yeah. So I have a challenging question. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, Michael. So, I mean, I think that the only option, as we would agree, is to go all in on humanoid robotics and artificial intelligence. But that decision was made in Elon's mind a long time ago. He's full steam ahead on both of those things. And he wants to ramp up Optimus manufacturing at an insane level. You know, he's talking about aspirational and order of magnitude per year. Maybe they only do 5x multiplier every year instead of 10.
Mm-hmm.
If he's going to do that, it's going to require supply chain and manufacturing. How would you be thinking about the calculus of how to achieve a order of magnitude increase in manufacturing capacity for humanoid robotics as an American company that preserves the United States advantage against China and doesn't rely on step in the same sand traps that other American industries have fallen into when they have wanted to grow capacity and then they have allowed China to capture their long-term prowess?
Think we do have some strong allies who know something about manufacturing. Japan I was just in Japan last week. Excuse me. Japan, Korea,
that's Germany. Xi Jinping calling right now.
Oh, fuck.
You better pick up.
Shut up.
What do I do? What do I do?
Sorry. Didn't even talk about. Go ahead.
I think it does take getting together with the Japanese, the Koreans, Indians, to take the best of what they have, and let's form a united front to counter what is otherwise, you know, almost an invincible manufacturing machine that is China. So that'd be my first thought: is we probably have lost some of the ability to think in terms of what does it take to build a world-class manufacturing operation. So let's take our AI and our innovation on that front, robotics, and then marry it with the best-in-class manufacturing systems from our allies. That would be my first take. Yeah. It will be tempting every step of the way because, you know, in the battery business, you go to the Koreans and the Japanese, and then you find out, oh, for their cell manufacturing and for their processing, all that's going back to China. Oh, my goodness. We haven't escaped the China warp. So let's try to be smarter and more disciplined and more patient and say this is a 10-year project, and we have to know who our friends are, who our allies are, and who have our best interests in. So that would be my take. Yeah.
What a freaking world we're about to enter into. I mean, this is such a thought-provoking, incredible conversation because it's really starting to put the pieces in play for what the next 5, 10, 20 years are really going to look like, truly actually going to look like.
Yeah, what are they going to look like? Yeah.
And it's like the China variable is by far the largest one because it dictates manufacturing capacity, it dictates supply chain, it dictates logistics, which very directly targets national security. Mm-hmm. Right, like over time, if you let those things come out of your purview, you end up becoming weaker and weaker and weaker because your economy suffers. Your labor base in the country will not have access to those jobs that will allow it to generate the earnings that is required to, you know, start up new businesses, you know, so on and so forth. Go ahead.
Right. Well, won't allow for the or you know, the ultimate, if we play this out, like we want the cheaper product, we want this cheaper product so much so that we don't have incomes anymore because everyone else is doing the thing. There is only one bigger question than the one you just raised with regards to future. So as far as that, I'm going to direct it to you. Are you ready?
Oh, God. No.
Penn State or Michigan next year?
Do we even play you guys this year? Let me see.
I'm not sure.
Penn State football schedule. I mean, you know how I'm
going. None of the above. Oregon will destroy
Oregon.
Get the fuck out of here. Dude, Oregon's going to get... You know we play Oregon the fifth week at Penn State. You guys are going to get fucking destroyed, Hans. You guys have no chance.
What do you say?
Yeah.
Penn State's going to... Well, we don't play you this year, Michael, so you're lucky because we're going to be the number one team in the country. So consider yourself lucky. Yeah. you guys got your national championship like 2 years ago. What are you complaining about?
I know. Look at this. We might have, is that going to be 3 years in a row then? Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State next year. The Big Ten is back.
Huge. And Oregon looks good. USC should be a little bit improved. Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan State might be better. I mean, the SEC, here's what happened. Now that they made the NIL a thing where you can pay players legally, the SEC can no longer cheat because they were paying players illegally. And now when you can actually pay players legally, what happens? The SEC is a terrible conference. Why? Because they've relied on really good players that they could pay under the table. And now that everybody can pay players, guess what? The Big Ten has the most CEOs, the most managers, the most millionaires, the most billionaires. Okay, so now that you open the floodgates for money, guess who's going to be the best? The Big Ten, because we're not a bunch of dummies like the SEC. There you go.
Is that why Oregon wanted to join the Big Ten, Hans?
So the Pac-12 was a friggin' dumpster fire. Getting out of the Pac-12 was definitely part of it. But yeah, like getting into a conference that's on the way up instead of on the way down, big factor.
It feels so good for years growing up in Michigan, and you know we'd have our Big Ten games, but as soon as we went south or west, you just usually get demolished. So it's great to see the Big Ten as a legitimate powerhouse now.
Yeah, the landscape has switched. I think, so it was Michigan 2 years ago, Ohio State last year, national champions. This year will be Penn State. Book it. 17-0. Just put it down on your piece of paper. All right. I do think the Big Ten is very well positioned coming up. You know, Alabama with their new coach, they, you know, they lost Nick Saban, DeBoer. I don't know if he has the right culture. Georgia with Kirby Smart. I mean, he's a great coach, but we'll see what they can do there. I don't know. I like the way it's going for the Big Ten. I'm excited.
I've written it down here. 17-0. Xi Jinping was, that's what he was calling about. He's like,
who should I put money on this year? All right. We're an hour in, Michael. I know you got a lot of stuff to do. So thank you so much for making the time. Where can people find you and your work?
First off, thank you. Always enjoy the conversation with you guys. I've been looking forward to this date for many weeks.
And we got to have you back too, Michael. Every time we've had you back has been amazing. So we'll definitely have you back here soon for sure.
Tremendous. Tremendous. DunInsights.com is the website. There's a newsletter there, a podcast, and lots of other fun data about electrics and batteries and autonomous vehicles worldwide. So check it out, DunInsights.com.
And then on X, at Dun_Insights as well. We'll put a link for that in the description below in the comments.
Perfect. Awesome. Yes.
Thank you, Michael.
Gentlemen.
Great.